Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the Lenten Rouge Cycling Podcast for our recap of the Tour of Flanders, both the men and women's race. Women's race just wrapped up. Clocks have changed, some European thing. We don't have that in Queensland, so I'm a little bit all confused by that. This episode is brought to you by Join Cycling. More on them in a second. But we'll start with the men's race first. 271 kilometers starting in Antwerp. Did it start in Bruges last year, Benji? Did they move the start?
That's a very good question. I think they moved it quite a lot in the past already, and maybe they're now switching every year back and forth. That's just in my head. Maybe.
No,
that's
they
how
did.
I remember it.
Yeah, so they started Antwerp, which is kind of like a Dutch, I think, a Dutch colony in Flanders, as I understand it, near the border.
You don't need to apply the Dutch practices already on Belgium. That's not true.
They got their own accent there. That starts in the north, the northeast, whereas Bruges last year, coming south from there, you have more wind possibilities. So we didn't really have crosswind possibilities today compared to last year. But they basically make their way down 130Ks to the first time out of Clermont, the longest climb of the race. They do that three times. 2.5Ks, about 5% with steeper parts in there, all cobbled before just a litany of 600-meter, 8% climbs before then the second time, Clermont. There actually are some easier phases in that race, and particularly a lack of cobbles after the Valkenburg to the second Clermont is about 30Ks that's not actually that difficult, and then it gets really hard again. Paterberg, 400 meters, 10%. Koppenberg, the only time, the hardest climb in the race. That's, how hard is Koppenberg? 600 meters at 10%, but 22% pinch. And then they go back and do the Kwamen Paterberg again before 12Ks or 14Ks into Oudenaarde Flat. And rainy conditions, not that cold, but the rain got more intense during the end of the race, Benji. But that's the route. Anything else before the race? Was there any news, really? I mean, we all know who's pulled out and who's starting. Vanderpool started the prohibitive favorite. There was no last-minute pullouts.
Well, no last-minute pullouts, but we weren't certain about a few riders. Like, for example, Trotnik, we weren't certain about. He's out. Kirsch, we didn't know his injury yet. He had actually had a fracture in the hand, so he's out as well for this race. So there's quite a few riders like that, and that does change the middle segment of this race, where you would expect other teams to try and put pressure on the Alpecin team to try and see how early they can force Vanderpool to be isolated. And that is a slight hit at the action we're actually going to see in this race. But let's start off with the simplicity, the start of the race, because we've got the breakaway formation. The first 60, 70 kilometers is how I would describe it. But I feel like the initial breakaway was formed quickly, but the breakaway formation took longer. So eight riders: Bert van Lerbergen, David Dekker, Anil Kowski, Touzé, Durbridge Reinders, two from Jayco, Tamignol from Lotto, and Jelle Vermolte from Bingel. So eight riders. But notably, when that group formed, the counterattacks just kept coming. And then we spotted two and a half teams controlling that, no?
Yeah, so DSM missed it. So Echoff and Frank Vandenbroek, they were trying forever. Bahrain wanted to be in. Ineos wanted to be in with like a Swift Viviani type operator, and maybe Bora wanted to be in, but DSM really wanted to be in. And then, so you're right. I found it very strange, Benji, how easily, because it wasn't. Durbridge went, three guys, good gap, brought back, and then Jayco go again with like six guys. And I'm like, where the hell are UnoX? Where the hell are the other teams wanting to maybe get in this break like a Tudor? And Trek, Alpecin were doing most of the controlling, I would say, of trying to stop moves going. I always find it slightly bizarre in this situation.
Yeah.
Jayco have two riders ahead. They're happy.
Yes.
Rajovic is jumping over and over again. And these teams do the very like conventional checkers move of closing Rajovic over and over jumping.
Mate.
What you should do is let him chasse patate and then the breakaway formation will finish.
And specifically for Rajovic, it's better for everybody's safety in the peloton than the guys in the breakaway. But I agree, is that continuous, first of all, the riders that aren't in the breakaway continue to try and get in it, the teams that aren't in the breakaway. In addition to that, Alpecin and Trek are also active on closing counterattacks. And the tertiary factor is, like you said, the teammates of the riders that are in the breakaway, like Quickstep as well with Asgreen, shockingly, also controlling moves. And I gotta be honest, Kasper Asgreen doing the breakaway formation work at Quickstep made no fucking sense.
That's unforgivable, man. Like, because even, I'm not talking like he's the first, he's not on Van der Poel's level, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But the guy won the race 2.5-3 years ago. He's also not that bad. He's still as good at, like, Visma don't have Tejs Benoot doing that job. He's as good as him. So that was very, very strange. And then the break just was at 20 to 30 seconds for so long that eventually Visma starts sniffing and they were trying to get in with Per Strandhagenes and Van Dijk. They were actually seeing moves where they could try get in the breakaway. But Alpecin weren't having any of that. Alpecin, they covered this, I think, very, very well. They didn't burn through too many riders. Dillier was all over it. Alpecin did a really good job in this phase.
What I also think when it comes to this breakaway is when I see this breakaway, I say, okay, it's not very strong. We've got lots of riders that are either lead outs, sprinters in 1.1 ChatGPT races. That's how I perceive this breakaway. So I don't see this as a dangerous breakaway. And if you're, for example, a team that does want to do something with the breakaway, why do we never really see it's not a strategy we see often, so maybe it's not the best strategy, but if you don't have the breakaway you want, can't they just give up on the breakaway and retry? Or are they too scared that they won't be in the second one?
Well, I think all those riders in that breakaway were happy with that breakaway. The problem is, like aren't Jayco happy with two? Aren't Cofidis happy to just be there? I mean, the people that are really unhappy are DSM Bahrain, Bingo Al, and Flanders Balwaza. Trek, I was perplexed because Trek last year got in the break with Dan Moto Hoel.
Yeah.
And he pulled the anticipation move with Merlier
to take
the gap to 3 minutes from the breakaway. So I was surprised they weren't also trying to sniff about and get in.
I feel like little Trek started this race feeling like they were still a co-favorite going into this race. We're going to help control the breakaway formation itself. We're not going to go into the breakaway. I would have done the opposite. I would have not helped the breakaway formation.
I would have tried
to get in the breakaway with the likes of the Clerc, because that way you are putting pressure on Alpecin. Last year, the pressure put on Alpecin in the first half of the race was very important for the middle hill zone.
Yeah.
And to see them not applying that seems counterintuitive and self-sabotage for any tactics later that might come up, which would involve trying to get one rider ahead or two riders ahead, stuff like that on little Trek side. You just can't do that if there's many Alpecin riders left. But anyway, that aside, that's the breakaway, and it's controllable, eh?
It's pretty, compared to the chaos of Roubaix and Flanders in previous years, I would say this is as calm as you could expect, because it goes, everyone has an orderly pee break when it gets to a minute, the gap goes out to three minutes, then 4 minutes, and before we get to an incident and a new rule I learned, mention my ramp test yesterday. I did a joint cycling ramp test. You can do DIY tests on joint cycling. I'm not a 20-minute FTP test indoors type guy. I think it, especially without the erg controlling, I don't know what was to do, or I might blow up as well. So I prefer the ramp test, even though, what do you think I did, Benji?
You know what I like to do? I like to do a ramp test followed up by an FTP test, because you then roughly have an idea of how you can pace it.
No, that's not how we're not doing it like that. that's just silly.
Go Come on, man.
No, I was so gassed. You ever get this thing where your airways hurt? I maybe I didn't warm up properly. No way I could have done a 20-minute test. Anyway, really happy with it because I'm setting, by the way, setting my zones correctly for the Fabio Jakobsen sprint plan, which I started the first workout of today. And exactly, everyone thought it was so funny to set it. I'm actually happy with it. I looked at it. It's like pretty much what I'd want to do, some decent volume with some sprints in there. So joke's on you. In the off season, by the way, everyone does sprints now, not just zone two. So joke's on everybody else. But yeah, did the ramp test. Obviously, there's a little bit of adjustment there afterwards where you're like, okay, my aerobic endurance actually isn't that good, so I have to downward adjust that. But that's what I'm really happy about, having those DIY tests in the app and then set my zones, and then I'm ready to go. And I did that today watching the race. So if you want to get on board with Join Cycling, there's those tests you can do and then get jump straight into a training plan for whatever your goals are. Maybe it is something like the Tour of Flanders. And yeah, I improved a lot. I did my best ever 5 minutes in 5 years, actually, off really not that much volume, just following the classics plan. And I had 10 days off. I did, yeah, my best ever 5 minutes for 5 years. So you can get 6 months at a discount and 30-day free trial with no credit card required through the link down below. Thanks to Join Cycling for sponsoring our Flanders recap, and as well for helping me get back on in the saddle and kicking my goals. Actually, I'm really happy with how it's going, and I can't wait to see where I'm at in about 8 to 12 weeks. Breakaway train. I didn't know this was a rule. A train comes across, the breakaway has to stop for 30 seconds. I then assumed that Peloton would be forced to give the 30 seconds back. I swear to God, Alpecin, man, nothing ever goes wrong for them in races. Not only is a good break gone, they get handed 35 seconds for free. Dillier must be laughing.
1 minute and 18 seconds was the count of Sporza. That is how much time that the breakaway lost at the rail crossing. And the rule is really stupid, eh? The rule is, if the breakaway has to stop and the peloton doesn't catch them, then they just restart from where they are at that moment. But if the breakaway is caught by the peloton at the rail crossing, they get the time they initially had when the rail arrived.
Oh, really? So if they were caught... So wait, when the railway opened up, they should have refused to pedal.
Well, no, the train should have been longer.
It's ridiculous. It's so tin pot. Like, I love some of the tin pot aspects of the sport. And then, because I random variance is fine, but the thing is, random variance like this doesn't even out. There's not going to be another train crossing for those guys in the breakaway this season. It's not like a baseball game where there's another 161 games to even out some random shit luck. Like, this is, yeah, I was very, very surprised. Maybe it's a safety issue.
I think it's maybe a logistical thing, but then on the opposite side, I remember last year maybe, Boasen Hagen or 2 years ago, attacked before a rail crossing, passed it, and then the peloton had to stop, and he gained that time. So the rule makes no sense.
Yeah. Anyway, for Alpecin, I think this went better than expected. They only used Dillier on the front. He's got a motorbike. Breakaway has no motorbike in front. He holds it like he lets it go three. He goes down to 3:30. He lets it go up to 4:10, 4:12. But he's only got to do this till Quarmont.
Yeah.
The first Quarmont. Because by then, every other team's going to start chasing full gas to get into position. And so he doesn't have to do this all day like in San Remo. So, yeah, really, really good situation for Alpecin. We get to the first time of the Alde Quarmont, and it's like last year. There's no chaos, no attacks. There was a huge push beforehand to get into position for the first time Quarmont. Alpecin had Van der Poel in good position. They were obviously worried that something could go so early. Then there was a really nasty crash. We never saw a replay of it because a spectator looked almost knocked out on the ground, virtually in the road. And we saw some riders held back, and Dylan van Baarle, who had been in okay position, he seemed to either be coming back from a puncture or he was way behind at this point. So going into the Kapellberg, Benji, which I thought was going to open this race up.
I was thinking the zone from Kapellberg to Valkenberg would be the zone where a shitload of people would start attacking the team of Alpecin, because that is the zone that is the most vulnerable, because you don't want to attack yet with Van der Poel himself if you're Alpecin. So that's where his teammates have to solve the issues. But like you said, relatively okay situation going into this zone, to be honest, but it didn't stay perfect necessarily. At what point did Søren-Kåre Andersen have a mechanical? Because I don't remember which climb that was.
It was really well timed, actually. It was in a flatter region. It was a bit later, I think. It was a little bit later, but when the first attacks had gone, but he actually had time to come back before maybe the Berchtenhauer. I think it was in that phase. But what was clear was the Alpes and Domestiques, these guys turn up for Monument Day. They have like the day where they need to be on. Okay, Omloop and Kerner, I couldn't tell you who was there, what they were doing. It's like the first Berg, gone, out the back. They are in position on every climb with Van der Poel in position perfectly, with guys keeping the overview with the numbers. They unbelievably good job in this phase. Look at Visma, it's Jorgensen. Benoit was there for a bit with Affini keeping him there.
Yeah.
And I think Tim van Dijk for a bit. Visma are thin on the ground. And by the way, for like the guys' second, third tier favorites, the race has not been hard up to this point. Like, there's no one that's actually cooked at this point. But Alpecin were just bossing it. UAE in decent position. Trek in also quite good position. But yeah, Dylan van Baarle coming back from that puncture. But he had time to come back before the Kapellberg. It was a long flat section and he doesn't... It takes a long time to get back. Nothing on the Kapellberg. Right. And then... Sorry, go on.
Van Baarle just has a positioning issue. And we see that not only here. We mentioned it so many times already this year, but it gets even more noticeable later in the race. But we'll get to that. You were saying Kapellberg, and nothing happens on the climb itself. It's kind of the sprint towards it, like in previous years. Like, I think last year, the first climb after was the Kortekeer, and we saw the same kind of activities where there was a harsh run-in, then it stops because everybody's thinking, oh, I need to go on the Wolvenberg afterwards for some reason. And then the year before that was the Achterberg, same exact scenario. And this time, Kapellberg, we see nothing on the climb itself, but on top, I saw an opportunity to do something, and UnoX uses that. Abrahamsen attacks, and that's where Alpecin does something. Alpecin chooses to send a rider, Axel Laurens, in this situation, with Abrahamsen in that move. And that's an indication of how they would respond to multiple attacks that came after. But were you surprised that they didn't just let Abrahamsen go? Because let's be honest about it, he's a good rider, but wouldn't be scared of him.
No, because Alpecin, they play a little bit, they balance the risk well. They don't want to just be that team that's pulling all day. They don't want to always be having to pull and chase. If the guy's there, he's able to go with it on the wheel because they're always in good position, like we just said. And why not? He has good legs. All of a sudden now, Visma, you do something. Little Trek, you do something. We have a rider ahead. I'm not sure if that's what happened or caused the Jorgensen move, but yeah, the Wolvenberg off basically not a big team like lead out or anything. Jorgensen goes on the Wolvenberg full gas.
Yep.
MVDP doesn't respond because he trusts his team. Two Alpecin de Koenig teammates, I think it might have been Søren-Kåre and one other, in the wheel of Jorgensen the whole way there. And it's still a big peloton at this point. So, it was just basically that. I would say that's a bullet from Jorgensen, Benji, with 12 Ks left. That was a bullet he spent.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the first attack of a competitor of Van der Poel. And Van der Poel has not really done that much at this moment. And that's exactly why this zone is the zone to attack him, because you want to force that team to disappear so he has to respond to things. And at a certain point, that does happen, but not yet here. Molenberg arrives. That's the cobbly one with the... You've got a very big road running. Goes into a left 90-degree corner. Very narrow. That's where those people went and did a shortcut under a tree a few years ago, but they blocked it off the recent years, so that's good. But this time around, we see Little Trek really being the team that pushes forward into the Molenberg, and Pedersen does the attack, and this time Van der Poel is responding, but Jorgensen is in second wheel, so you've got a bit of a gap to Van der Poel initially, but Van der Poel closes that relatively comfortably, to be honest, and they get to the top end there with three riders, Pedersen, Jorgensen, Van der Poel. We got to keep in mind, there's still a breakaway ahead, but it's like 2 minutes ahead. Still that same breakaway from at the start. But in the peloton, those three riders are ahead of the rest, ahead of a group of like 8 to 10 riders, and then the rest of the peloton. But that all comes together after the Molenberg, because Pedersen, Jorgensen, and Van der Poel, there was some interest to ride, but not by everyone and not at full. So others wanted to come back, and they did. So we're getting the situation afterwards where there's now less Alpecin Domestiques, because yeah. on Molenbeek they were kind of called behind, and then some were in second group, some were in third group, and GAD gives opportunities for riders to actually get ahead, right?
Yeah, it's exactly what happened last year. Asgreen did what Pedersen did on the Molenbeek. Yep. MVDP was right there. People attacked it just after in the regroupment, and MVDP says, too early, not my problem. And he gambled here. And at the time, it looked like he gambled badly, because Dylan van Baarle comes back and does, he's the one that initiates. There was a few count anticipations. Van der Poel, I think, was marking Jorgensen, and van Baarle was the one who jumps. He goes with strong guys, and he goes with Trek. He doesn't have FDJ, but then Benoit also jumps across. Narsen, who's in good shape, Van Moer. And also, Alpecin put a... Pedersen, most importantly, is the Trek rider, so they are happy. There's a Bora, maybe two. Alpecin also put a rider in, which is risky, because you don't have that rider to chase behind, and the other... Pedersen doesn't care if Vermeers is in the group. He'll beat him later. So this is exactly the group style of group that went in exactly the same place last year and took 3 minutes. But the difference was here, and it gets across the breakaway. Benoit is pulling full gas, looks like, for van Baarle. They're pushing really, really hard. Jorgensen's in the wheels behind. Kung has a crash, so FDJ, despite missing it, they're not chasing full gas. Pithy's just in the wheels. And Alpecin, I think this might be the difference between either, I don't know. This is probably the difference from that crosswind section last year, Benji. Because they have three guys, Sir and Kra, doing basically a lead out into the, what's it start with, T? Tiefenberg? It's like a, it's not that hard.
It's not the Tiefenberg. It was the, oh God, what is the name of that stupid climb? It also wasn't the Marlborough Straat. It was the...
Berndries or after?
Falkenberg? Falkenberg.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. I was going through them on the profile in my head.
But yeah, MVDP had seen for a moment before they start pacing, he seemed like he didn't know what to do. And this is why what he did with Milan in Gent-Wevelgem was so out of character, because chasing a guy for like 80Ks to go, because here in the big race, of course he doesn't do it. He waits for his domestiques to chase. And yeah, they do a lead out. He has to spend a bullet though, Benji.
Yep.
This is again, Alpecin Domestiques, unbelievable job. Because if he doesn't have them there doing the full lead out, he's not able to bridge on that climb, because the gap would have been 45 seconds.
And the important moment is that Van der Poel doing that, bridging on the Valkenberg, means he closes the group with the likes of Pedersen, with the likes of Van Baarle, with the likes of Benoit, and so forth. The rest of the peloton was dropped. Like, they were trying to catch up one by one, then a group of four, then a group of five, then the rest of the group, stuff like that. But Van der Poel getting to the front stops the tempo in the front group, which then causes, on paper, a perfectly timed attack of Mads Pedersen, attacking just as Van der Poel closes in. But the problem is, he gets away, not alone. He gets away with Vermeersch. Alone would have been bad as well, but Mads Pedersen and Vermeersch get a gap. Vermeersch sitting in the wheel at first, gap of maybe 5 to 10 seconds initially. And then I'm thinking, okay, Pedersen is looking behind him. He wants someone with him right now.
It's the right move. But just to say, when he first jumps, Visma should have been jumping with him.
Exactly.
FDJ, Bora, UAE. When Van der Poel gets there, everyone stops. You have to go again, because the idea is to, everyone doesn't want to be going to the Koppenberg with Van der Poel, okay? Yep. With 40Ks, 45Ks to go. So they're trying to get ahead, and they're running out of climb to do it before the climb on. So like the Pedersen, yeah, you're right. The initial jump, Benji, is correct. Other teams should have been doing it. But then, like, what did you... I very quickly was like, this is not a situation he should continue with.
Exactly. And especially once the group behind started forming a proper peloton behind Pedersen and Vermeersch.
Huge.
There's a gap of 15 to 20 seconds now. And Johnny Vermeersch is starting to ride with Pedersen. And at first you're like, why is Vermeersch riding there? And then in the back we've got Alpecin riding. But Alpecin also knows that if Pedersen, the longer he stays in front, the longer he's fucking himself over. The guy has literally entered, Mads Pedersen has entered a sunk cost fallacy. He's so far into this attack that he doesn't want to give up anymore. But he's basically destroying his own race here.
He has an Alpecin Domestique in the wheel. And, okay, I think it's okay to keep going with Vermeersch because you drop him later until you see what's happening in the peloton behind, like you said. But as soon as the team car sees Alpecin put two Domestiques on the front, and you're riding with an Alpecin rider in your wheel and two Domestiques, who, by the way, they're losing no time to you. They're deliberately holding you at 25 seconds. You have to stop. You have to stop before and then jump again with Wellens, with Pollitt, with Nico Denz, or I don't know, with Benoit before, or with Narsen before the second time Quarmon. And actually, this worked out perfectly for Alpecin, because what they want to do, right, Alpecin want to, they want the race to chug along with these small gaps and with a bit of jump being controlled and little Trek help control it. And then Asgreen maybe a little solo move. Okay, no bother, they control it. And it goes from 20 to 25. And they want the race to chug along deep into the race so the Van der Poel can then mano-a-mano kill everyone in the end. They don't want the group that initially formed of 10 guys to go. That's when you see them panicking, doing the lead out and Van der Poel spending a bullet. But this, they're happy with. And then, Benji, did you think at one point that Pedersen was like killing himself so for Schoens? I didn't. I just thought it was like, I get to one, it is the car's failure. Maybe it's not necessarily his fault, but because they had it's 30 kilometers, man. They had 45 minutes to be like, this is, you're killing your race here.
That was one of the worst tactical moves I've seen in this year. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, because he had good shape.
And maybe, yes, maybe they were thinking, we're in the situation of Hans Wevelgem, right? We're pushing Alpecin to spend their riders on closely on Peters, but you're forcing them to spend their domestiques on your leader. Like, the trade-off isn't worth it. If it's Pedersen and Alpecin behind with screens in the wheel, I would at one point maybe think, okay, maybe, because Pedersen maybe feels bad for his crash, and as a consequence that way. But you're basically just riding domestiques in the ground, which at that point, it's kind of too late for it already, I feel like. Like, you can do that with screens ahead, maybe. Then I'd be like, okay, I can see you what you're trying to do, the same as you did with Milan and Hans Wevelgem, but with Pedersen, it's just fucking terrible strategy. I can't even say it much nicer than that. And Vermeersch riding with him, I kind of liked it, because
it was smart.
It made it, so Pedersen had to... that Pedersen was more likely to continue going with whatever the fuck he was doing. And we're getting closer to Berchtenhouten now. We're still not even in like the... We still haven't arrived at the outer quarter on Paterberg, the second last one. So I love that this race opens up early with these moves and so forth. Berchtenhouten, we see some anticipations from the peloton, Asgreen trying to get away, stuff like that. But it quickly becomes clear that Alpecin's not the team pacing anymore on Berchtenhouten. UAE is now coming to the front with a lead out for Tim Wellens. And when looking at the parkour, Berchtenhouten is kind of one of the two climbs that I would launch Wellens on if I would want to launch him. That and maybe out of Quarmont, right?
Yeah, Albert Andries, he's good on those sort of climbs.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah,
but then you're right, because now Pedersen, Alpecin have got it close enough to Quarmont that other teams start doing lead outs.
Yeah.
And so UAE, they got Bjerg just like he did last year for Pogacar, doing a lead out, and MVDP, since he spent the bullet on the Valkenburg, is in the wheels the whole time, chilling, recovering for what, 40 minutes, maybe 35 minutes. So perfect situation, perfect execution by Alpecin. We get to the second climb on 56 k's to go. Lazcano starts pacing really, really hard. We can't see any yellow Visma Lisa bike jerseys, just about maybe Jorgensen 10th wheel. They don't enter in good position, and you can't see Van Baarle or the others. And Van der Poel goes over the top of Lazcano, I think before the town of Quarmont, Benji? And then on the flatter section, Lazcano reeled him back in. It didn't look like Van der Poel was going clear for good at that point. Not like when Poggi went last year, it was like, wow, he's really creating a big, big gap.
Exactly. It was kind of the first punch on the outer Quarmont. And like you said, the Lazcano pacing, catching Pedersen, Piffy still trying to follow, still in the mix. Like, I was actually very happy to see Piffy in this race, but it also means that it has not been the most traditional race up to this point. Even with those attacks, the race was kind of locked up when Pedersen was ahead. Because how I see it, Pedersen not only caused his own race, his own energy to be drilled through, but he also made it so that all the other riders that we saw as the second row, they couldn't really do those moves anymore before the outer quarter one, right?
Exactly. So, I agree with you.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, by the time we get to the second quarter, I'm like, this race is finished. This race is finished because you can't get a big enough gap. There's too many. You have then Paderberg, Kloppenburg, and then Kwamont and Paderberg again. There's too many climbs now, back to back, where Van der Poel can just kill everybody. And so really, and then he already showed he was still on a good day on the Kwamont. Lascano comes back to him. There's a group with Pedersen who does make it over. Wellens, I think. Garcia Cortina might have been there, but no Visma. Visma eventually come back. Group of 20 comes together. And again, not there were a few riders, but only like someone like Garcia Cortina lived in reality today. His reality was, if I go to the Paderberg with Mathieu van der Poel, I'm going to get dropped badly. And probably by Tim Wellens. So he was like, anytime he could, anticipate. And he did before the... after the Paderberg, sorry. On the Paderberg, there wasn't really anything crazy, no, but just Lascano was a little bit worse and Jorgensen was a bit better than he was on Kwamont.
You just saw that the 200-kilometer mark was reached and that people started dropping through the group gradually. The riders that might not be here like at their best level, you start seeing that there. And like you say, Garcia Cortina makes that move after the Paderberg. And I got to be honest, going into this race, I was thinking, okay, which teams can try pull a pressure Alpecin with a numerical advantage? Well, Visma in the past, maybe not with the team they had left starting today. Trek in the past, maybe not with the team they had left starting today. Never thought it would be Movistar.
The ghost.
They were attacking with Garcia Cortina. And Lascano was in the wheel of Van der Poel in the group behind. That was peak, like, that was peak cycling, peak ciclismo right there. I love that. Absolutely love that. But that is going from the Paterberg into the Koppenberg. And the Koppenberg today, both in the men's and the women's race, was extremely decisive. Not just because certain riders could use it to ride away, but because it was in a bad condition in the rain today, even though there's a man in this podcast sitting across from me, well, not exactly across, but that rode in these exact conditions up the Koppenberg without having to walk on the Koppenberg. But Garcia Cortina, suddenly we get a front shot of the steepest segment. He's standing still, having to walk, tries to get up his bike on a 20% section, like, which is very difficult, unless you have like perfection when it comes to technique. So I was like, mate, when I saw that shot, I was like, run, Yvonne, run! I had the feeling of Chris Froome running for the first time in a while.
And he'd done the perfect thing, anticipating more riders should have done it after the Paderberg. And yeah, it wasn't just wet, by the way. Yes, did I get off the bike when I did the Koppenberg? No. I, of course, did it fully. But yeah, 1500 watts for 50 seconds is, you know, just built different, I guess. But they had to, but there was mud all over it today. So you're then having to do 20% with mud, one guy on clips, all over. And then, Van der Poel just goes to the front and drops everybody. Jorgensen's best of the rest. I don't know if he necessarily was stronger than Terns and Bettiol at this moment, because Bettiol got screwed over by basically a blockage being put on the Koppenberg and having to walk up it, because Bettiol looked very, very strong and then had to, to walk it. So Van der Poel goes clear, Jorgensen on 8 seconds, and everyone's still walking the Koppenberg.
At least 25 people of the 35, I think 25 of the 30, maybe, of the first 30, had to walk up the Koppenberg, is how I perceived it. So many people are walking next to their bike up the Koppenberg, up the steep segment, and trying to get back on their bike afterwards. And the guy that had the worst of all was Lascano, who basically started in the group of Van der Poel and then ended in group 3 or 4 in the group with Victor Kampenaerts and so forth. So that dude had so much trouble jumping back on the bike multiple times on the Koppenberg that climb literally ruined his race. And this reminds me of last year, but also previous editions. Last year, the women's race, where that's where the decisive move in the women's race last year happened, where a few riders just rode off into the distance and the rest was blocked by a crash and so forth. And This is exactly what happens here, and does it... Maybe we should answer this after we discuss it through the women's race as well, but does the Koppenberg make the race better like this, or worse?
I think it clearly made it worse in the men's race.
Yep.
Because second-tier contenders... I'm not saying they would have caught Van der Poel, but they... they wouldn't have given him a minute head start having to walk it. So, you know, I wouldn't say that makes the race better. And it's not like a skill issue either.
Yeah.
Like, there's guys aren't clipping and blocking them in front of them. So, no, it did not make it better. And
well,
it
maybe
should,
it's a skill issue from the riders in front of them.
Well, I mean, yes, Van der Poel entered in good position. Therefore, he had no one doing that in front of him so he could pick his line. So, there is some element of skill to it. But I would say that it being covered in mud is not ideal. Yeah. Jorgensen's on 7 seconds. He gets it down to even maybe 6 seconds, gets to a false flat bit on the highway on the big roads. And you see one thing. Jorgensen looking down, going full gas. Van der Poel going the same speed, having a gel, playing with his head unit. And you just know immediately that he's going to crack him just the same way he cracked Van Aert in E3 last Friday, a couple of Fridays ago. And that's exactly what happens. The gap goes then, starts going to 9 seconds, and then quickly turns very, very far south as Jorgensen cracks completely. So I think, and then the race is over, 43 Ks to go. Like we saw this at E3 with an even longer solo maybe, that they're not going to catch Van der Poel. The next group is at 1 minute with turns Bettiol, Rex, Benji.
Yes. So MDP, then Jorgensen, like you said, was deteriorating, but he was still in second position. And Pedersen, Rex, Bettiol, Garcia Cortina, Wellens, and Turns. That was the group behind that. But outside of Van der Poel, for the rest of the race, everything behind him was really close together. Like, I'm talking, if you have the legs, you can jump from group four to group two or something on a Pauter Berg. But of course, nobody has good legs anymore. That's why they're in a different group. But I do feel the Koppenberg made maybe an unfair distinction between certain riders, because I swear between the Koppenberg and the last Oude Quaremond and Paterberg, a lot of switching happened between the second, third, and fourth group when it comes to riders. For example, headline number one, Pedersen, Jorgensen completely implode.
Yeah,
I'm not talking they drop back to group three. They drop back through group three, through group four, and I mentioned Kampenaerts on the Koppenberg. Kampenaerts almost actually dropped them on the last part already. So they were fucked. And that is because Pedersen put so much into the race in the middle segment. That is because Jorgensen was the one that shot the first bullet on the Wolvenberg and then tried to follow every other favorite move while the others are just trying to survive at a tempo they can... They don't have to attack to win the race. And I think that saves them the energy in the long run, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. You're dealing with different things, you know? Like, Luca Mozzato is not trying to open it up on the Wolvenberg, is he? or even initiate in the middle phase. I mean, I back the man. He could. But right, Van der Poel goes clear. He's, even if he cracks, he's going to win the race. That's very clear. We'll cut to the chase. He wins the race. His third Tour of Flanders victory, equaling some of the greats. His fifth consecutive podium, which I think is almost equally crazy, because that means you've almost had no horrendous luck. Or, except maybe in 2019 he did, because no crashes to podium this sort of chaotic race 5 years in a row is madness. Bettiol and Turns jump ahead. They look the strongest on the climbs. But unfortunately for them, UAE come back with four riders, Morgado, Wellens, Pollitt, and Bjerg. They're with... They've dropped Pedersen. They've dropped Jorgensen. They've got Oliver Nasen. Magnus Sheffield is there, as well as Luca Mozzato and Tom Schoens and Michael Matthews. And they actually... I was going to start saying the UAE meme thing. In the end, they actually all four did pull through.
Yeah.
UAE actually, they pulled through.
And it was important because at first there was a two-man chase behind Van der Poel, being Bettiol and Dylan Teuns, who...
Yeah.
2 days ago, I was thinking Dylan Teuns not looking that good high at Israel, but right now I'm like, holy shit, he was one of the best riders at Ronde van Vlaanderen, and the Hill Classics are coming. So I'm now really hyped to see what he can do for that team in those races. Today changed my mind significantly on him. And UAE helped with their four riders to catch those two riders back, then be able to fight for that second position in the first place. So I think that's, I think they played their cards relatively well when it comes to UAE. And in addition to that, I would say, because it was such an open race behind Mathieu van der Poel, you already mentioned them, Morgado, Sheffield, two youngsters in fifth and sixth in this race. That's crazy. Morgado with a really good race. I think it's his first monument, if I recall correctly. Sheff also being in a race. We know he crashes a lot, but this performance is really fucking good on a race that is relatively crash prone, I would say. Riley Sheehan, 13th. What do you think when it comes to Roubaix?
Yeah, he should be good there, because obviously on the steep climbs, he's not as good. But yeah, really, he won Paris-Tours obviously last year. Wait, did you do the sprint?
I did not do the sprint.
UAE bring it back. We see Bettiol and Turns there on their last legs on the false flat uphill drag in the finish. Michael Matthews opens up the sprint, gets into their slipstream, then goes all the way to the right-hand side. And then unlike what he didn't do in MSR, where he probably could have got away with it, here he really puts Pollitt into, not into the barriers, but he completely blocks Pollitt on the to the right, to the left barriers as we look at it. And actually Luca Mozzardo comes out of his wheel and nabs second. So if you had Luca Mozzardo down to Podium Tour of Flanders, my credit to you. Matthews gets relegated.
Yes.
Which is a delta of 410 UCI points, just quietly. And Pollitt takes,
I will say,
third.
That's your fault that Matthews got relegated.
My fault.
You were hammering home the point during MSR that it should have closed to the barrier. So Matthews saw the podcast and thought, I should close to the barrier.
Here he swung the whole road in.
He took it too seriously.
MSR, he had to move 6 inches. And also, I was going for the Dubski. And Pollitt also wasn't going to beat him in this sprint, even if he left the door open. That's the thing. So UAE actually finished 3-4-5. So Van der Poel wins, Mozzardo second, Pollitt, Bjerg, Morgado fifth, unbelievable result. Sheffield, Oliver Narsen, Dylan Turns, Bettiol ninth. Those two deserve maybe a little bit better. Skjørns 10th, Matthews 11th, and Tarling 17th also, I think, merits mention.
And I think Kamil Malechkin 14th is also a name that shows up in my mind. You remember that Polish guy that broke his pelvis at, I think, Lotto in 2021 that might not walk again? That's that guy.
Really?
He just finished 14th in RVV 3 years later. And I think that's a performance that we need to highlight.
I think the big takeaways for me are, for this race, going toe-to-toe with MVDP really hurts everybody that does it.
Yeah.
Including even MVDP. And that's why it would have been interesting if there wasn't that on the Koppenberg, the full blockage, because MVDP, he was pretty fucked in the last 10Ks. He was, I mean, everyone's on their knees, but he also was kind of cooked. When you see a guy in a monument one-day race in the last 4Ks take a gel, that means they are cooked, right? And you look at the guys that went toe-to-toe with him. Jorgensen, he finishes 31st on 338. Lawrence Pithy, 39th on 430. Mads Pedersen finishes 22nd on 241. Even Wellens, who is the most active, actually, of the UAE riders, is the fourth finisher of the UAE riders on 116 in 12th. And so it really seems like the riders who didn't participate in the chaos between Wolvenberg and the second and the Koppenberg, who kind of just did their own pace there, the riders like Mozzardo, like Pollitt, they actually benefited from that in the end. And guys like Jorgensen completely cracked.
It's almost as if riding for second, third, fourth, fifth, or just top 10 or something, benefits you more than attacking. It's kind of logical if you think about it in a full-on attrition race, that the more shots you do early, the more it's going to cost you towards the end. But I will say, I wasn't expecting Mozzardo to finish second, to see Morgado finish top five, to see Sheffield finish top 10, that kind of stuff, you know? Are you laughing at the fact that I just launched fireworks, or?
A little bit. It reminded me of Omloop a bit, actually, with the group coming back. I don't think someone like Jorgensen should regret anything. I actually think he tried to win the race and it,
agreed.
You know, it didn't work out. I think when he needed teammates to be jumping as well or doing lead outs, the Visma, I know they had no Laporte, I know they had no Van Aert, but the positioning compared to the Alpecin guys, by the way, the Alpecin guys who are not monument podium guys or monument top 10 guys like Benoit, like Van Baarle, those Alpecin guys were in position all day today when it mattered.
Yeah.
And making the right moves like Axel Laurence. And so I think Alpecin also outplayed Visma. Apart from that one group with Van Baarle and Benoit, that was dangerous. Alpecin had to panic. There, the race could have been a bit different, but Alpecin were good enough to solve it.
They had a plan to solve that issue, or they made up a plan in the moment to solve that issue as it showed up. Does that plan only become possible if Van der Poel still has three teammates there? Yes. But that's also because things left and right did help them a bit when it comes to their teammates. First of all, the rail crossing might have been given Dillier 3% more energy by the time he reached the hills, but I don't think that changed the race at all. Then looking at Lil Trek helping them with the breakaway formation instead of trying to be in the breakaway, I think that's a factor. I don't think that's going to change too much, but that's actively playing in the hand of Alpecin and kind of hurting their own race. So I think some teams could have played things differently. Would it have changed the results? Probably not. But maybe their own rider wouldn't have finished 22nd.
You know who wins this race by a minute?
Pogacar?
Yeah.
Easily.
I think so, yeah. I think on that second Quarmont, I'm sorry, but Oya Lazcano is not closing down Poggi on that second Quarmont.
Yeah.
I think he goes bye-bye there. Especially in the rain, he's good. And DU18, by the way, have had three guys in the top five. So the team could have done a pretty good job for him too, one would think. So yeah,
mate,
it's actually...
this is better for them. More UCI points than Pogacar first.
True. Actually, they come out of it. You're right. Over 1,000 UCI points. High IQ plays. okay. But yeah, Van der Poel wins another monument. It's after the 10-year extension with Canyon, he keeps winning.
Yeah, but
and
not a very memorable edition, not gonna lie. Very forgettable.
Really?
this is not an edition that will be memorable to me. And I think maybe it's me, but I kind of feel like I want to see the old RVV parkour again.
Yeah,
I'm done with it.
I mean, I agree with you. Like, they came into Saint Croix and I was like, I know what's gonna happen. Like, I know already it's done. And yes, but why should they change the parkour? Because one guy's one of the best classics riders ever.
Well, it's not just this year, eh? I feel like in previous years, last year we knew Pogacar was the strongest before the race started and that the parkour would probably play out with him winning, but it was a good race last year. I won't deny that, but I don't know. It's just that I kind of want to see the old parkour again for 1 year. I want to see how the current generation races on the old RVV parkour. Maybe just this personal nostalgia of the memories of Cancellara having a hunger knock in the middle of the Muur van Gerardsbergen in the last 20 kilometers to then see the likes of Nick Nyens winning that race, stuff like that. The memories are there for me, and I want to see how the current generation does it on there.
Yeah, it would be cool to spice it up because, yeah, it's like the big guns come to the last 55Ks here and they just go bye-bye. Even if Pogacar's here, then he goes bye-bye with Van der Poel. Obviously, Van Aert crashing out Wednesday didn't help, but you never know what would have happened either. We saw in E3 that Van der Poel was significantly better as well. So that I'm not sure that necessarily means it would have changed too much. On to the women's race, where there was a lot of action early.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Some off camera. This race has the same final as the men's race. It's 163 Ks long. They do the Molenberg, Berendries, Valkenburg combo. They skip the Berchtenhalter. And then they do the Koppenberg, Tienberg, Oudekwamont and Paderberg combination. So, the same final there before a flat run into the finish. In Oudenaarde, the weather got progressively worse for the women. Started raining a lot. And one would assume the mud got worse on the Koppenberg after the men churned it up. And but before coverage started, Benji, there was some bad crashes.
Yep. Reusser crashed, Deignan crashed, a big crash. Deignan broke her radial head on her right arm, if I recall correctly. Reusser broke her right jaw. So consequences for those big guns in the race. Reusser obviously reducing the strength of his D-Works, while Deignan reduces the strength of Little Trek in this race. And I don't know about other riders, but there were quite a few on the ground, so maybe there's other consequences for other riders as well. This is fairly early on in the race, though. So whoever was in this crash and wasn't hurt, their race wasn't necessarily affected by it. Obviously, Reusser and Deignan was affected by it. Later, I basically started tuning in after the men's race, which was in the run-in towards the Molenberg, and we had a crash right there from Elisa Longoborghini. She actually returns by the time the foot of the Molenberg happens, but that's kind of a fake news thing, eh? Returning at the foot of the Molenberg is a poison chalice, because the way the peloton goes into that Molenberg, I repeat, big road goes into small road after a 90-degree corner onto steep cobbles. This means you've got a peloton of 35 seconds long, so Longoborghini catching up means she's 35 seconds behind the front of the race. But on that, we did have, we basically had some DSM pacing. So nothing crazy happened on that Molenberg. I got to remind you, at this point, we've got five breakaway riders, including the likes of Mickey Dogs, Hikiere, Gladys Verhulst as well, for example. And I kind of feel like the race is still all back together with about 70 kilometers to go. Now, before we jump into the actual action, the decisive action, which once again also kicks off with the Koppenberg, when a rider crashes in a race and you're a spectator by the side of the road, don't do what the guy did with Anja Lau from AG Insurance.
Yeah.
She fell. The guy started picking her up. If she has an injury, a back injury, a pelvis injury, you're making it worse.
I saw this the other day in the men's race. There was another men's race. I don't know if it was a crash in Hennevevelin or E3, Benji.
The
guy was a manhandler. And they crashed real hard on the tarmac.
Yeah.
And the guy was hurt, like fucking hurt, and like with his back. And this guy's manhandling him against his will off the road. Like, how dumb do you have to be to do that? And also, spectators today, not sure their best day either. There was maybe a jacket that caused a crash again at some point during the race. So, yeah, you know my view on this. My controversial opinion is I loved watching the race during COVID.
Because no one was there.
You could hear them and there was no spectators with jackets. But yeah, that was a shame. But Koppenberg.
About spectators, before we get to the Koppenberg, are you personally annoyed by the booing and the throwing beer and stuff at rider? The throwing beer I am against.
Yeah, you can't.
Booing,
you can't,
I don't like it, but
you can't throw things at people.
Yeah. I think so too.
But the booing is like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, this is sports here. I mean, it's a little sticks and stones and all that. Like, you can't throw beer and things at people. That is inappropriate. And that's a different across the line. But just booing someone because you don't like them, sport on. Go play an NFL or NRL game or AFL game. or cricket game. Yeah, obviously these people never came out to bat if they're complaining about that and had a whole slip scored. And I remember when I was 17, I started an English accent. Whole slips called and come out Saturday morning, just finished school. Yeah. And there's just like a bunch of like 30-year-old blokes just giving it to me as I come out opening bat. But yeah, that no way the booing would be as bad as that if you play great cricket in Australia. Anyway.
What sport are we talking about?
Cricket.
Oh, okay.
So basically in cricket, you're standing there in the middle of the pitch and there's all these people just surrounding you. And they just—it's called sledging. Boo! They don't just—they chirp you. They say, "Oh, your mum just dropped you to the game, buddy. You tell her to go pick you up shortly because you ain't going to be out here too long."
Jesus Christ!
That's funny. You just laugh at it. Anyway, I just taught Benji sledging. We'll bring you up to speed for the Ashes this year. Koppenberg. This is where it kicks off for the women's race once again. The mud, the carnage. Lead out by Visma. Voss has obviously been in fantastic shape, in good position. They enter with her. Puck Peterser, who's in great shape today, and Vibers Benji, who I've underrated and you said she'd be like this, they enter in fantastic position and they smash, well, not smash, they just survive the Koppenberg, right?
Yeah, they survive, but also Voss is actively like pacing at a solid tempo. But we learned last year on the Koppenberg in the women's race, also in the men's race today, when someone in the group goes vertically across the road or horizontally, depending on how you look at the road, or someone crashes, everybody behind that rider is fucked. Completely fucked. And this time around, we saw a rider in fourth, fifth position, maybe a bit further than that, Digard, falling to the left side of the road. She kind of slids off the mud by the side of the road, onto the road, which causes all the riders behind her to have to go walking. Now, Kopecky was already past this point, if I recall correctly, but at a certain point, she did have to get off the bike and also start running on the Koppenberg. Seeing Lotte Kopecky run on the Koppenberg, that to me shows how bloody hard that climb sometimes can be in these situations. And the funniest shot comes a bit later. First of all, Voss, Peterser, Wiebes, the likes of Nivia Doma, I think Longo Borghini got relatively well over it as well. Then Paternoster got over it quite well. Persico and Swinkels, I think, as well. Curinier, she might have been there or the group behind, but the group behind. That was Kopecky walking, Vollering riding past her as Kopecky's walking up the Koppenberg or running up the Koppenberg. They're talking to each other. That is the shot of this race for me. Just like Vollering riding past Kopecky as she's running on the Koppenberg. It's a really funny picture. And they get to the top and the gap is 35 seconds. I repeat, Wiebes, Nivia Doma, Peterse, Longo Borghini, Paternoster, Voss, Persico, Swinkels with a 35 second gap on Kopecky, Vollering, Curinier, Van Androy, Georgie, and Van Empel. So that's 8 versus 6 riders. And I look at that situation and I'm like, well, SD-Works fucked it. And it's partially their own fault, I'd say. Their position going into this race, into this Koppenberg, I mean, a specific climb, wasn't good enough with Kopecky and Vollering. And then they're caught behind crashes, caught behind stuff happening on the Koppenberg. And after last year, where they totally benefited from the situation, they should have known better. It's either that, or they already didn't have the legs on this climb to be in the position that they needed to be in. Which was it, you think?
I think a bit of both, because they've not been as dominant where they could just do what they wanted, like in previous years. And they must have known, like, it's the Koppenberg, man. It's not like a random moment. So, yeah, I think it has to be legs, because Vibers knew and she was right then. What did you then do, Benji? Like, at what point do you trust Vibers in the group ahead? Because she was pulling, right? Not full gas, but she was rotating through. Like, it's tough to know if Kopecky's looking really bad. And didn't Kopecky then drop on, like, the next climb?
Yes, that is true. It was on the Tyenberg, the climb just after that, Kopecky started dropping in group two. And this is the group with Vollering in it. Vollering was pacing in that group. I will say, Swinkels pacing in the front group for Persico. So you've got two people pacing against each other basically at this point. Vollering gradually closing in. But with Kopecky, I feel like on the Koppenberg itself, I looked at her and I felt like, first of all, on paper, white bib shorts plus 50 watts. But I think she might have put them up.
Not when they turn brown.
The other way around. Because she got minus 50 watts. Because she honestly didn't look amazing on the Copa Medi. I was expecting her to be at the front, to be more vibrant, and that was not the case. So at that point, I was like, it doesn't look that great. Vollering looked better on the Copa Medi. And like you said, Steinberg, Group 2, Kopecky dropping. She returns just after that, though. And we get to the outer Kreisberg. We're 29 kilometers to go. The gap is still about 30 to 25 seconds is my pure guess between the two groups. And we see a move in the first group. We see a move from Elisa Longo Borghini. Basically, no one drops. So pretty hyped up this move while nothing really happened. In group two, Courinier, really strong ride by her for FDJ, but she mechanicals basically out of contention. And we got to keep in mind, the second group is where shit goes down. Kopecky fully dropped right now. Vollering is pacing, drops the rest of that group too, except Shirin Van Enrooy. Van Enrooy gets to the wheel and keeps on following that wheel. And right on top, at the front of the race, Longo Borghini hits it again. And now she's doing so with Kasia trying to close, with Wibbes trying to close, Vos, Pater Noster, Buck Peterson, Persico, and again, that happens, but then you get the counter from Kasia Nevyedova, ELB closing it, and these moments, like, shit was going down in both groups, right? Because Vollering was dropping everybody behind while stuff was happening at the front, then there's this one moment where Kasia and ELB are just hitting it again, just as Vollering is about to catch up, right? And then Vollering drops again.
It's the tricky thing for SD Works. Is Vibas the strongest? Because she made that group one in the first place. Yeah. Is Kopecky, is she going to come good in the climb? She just had a weak moment. Is Vollering actually their best option and they should have Vibas wait for her? Impossible to really know at that time, and I was really trying to figure it out myself. ELB, for sure, like you said, looked incredibly strong. We come into the run into the Quarmont, fast descent, Vollering's made it back, and Van Enrooy smashes from the back of the group. They didn't even know she was there. Svinkels follows, but actually never gets to her wheel. And this is where I was very surprised, because Kopecky's basically helped Vollering bridge across, and then neither Vibas nor Vollering, and it should have been Vibas in hindsight, Vibas doesn't react at all. Now, maybe she doesn't get to the wheel initially on this descent, but also she doesn't start pacing to control it, nor does Vollering. Yep. And this gap to Van Enrooy gets out of control, goes to 30 seconds, because Vos basically goes to the front soft pedaling, because there's two SD Works in the group, and Kopecky's trying to come back, and then Peterson actually tries to bridge solo, and Vos is soft pedaling before the Quarmont. So Van Enrooy enters the Quarmont. This is like 15 k's to go, 17 k's to go. 30 second gap. Schwinkels is never making it. Peterson gets across on the Quarmont to her, but also never makes it to Van Enrooy. And then Quarmont, it's all together. Kopecky comes back, starts pacing. Maybe that's why SD Works waited to play devil's advocate.
Maybe.
Kopecky starts pacing and she looks much better now. And actually, I'm thinking Vos, this is great for Vos. She's got Kopecky pacing full gas. She's the quicker sprinter. And she's really controlling this to Van Enrooy. Who knows? Van Enrooy might blow up. We get to the Paterberg, right turn. Van Enrooy still got a big gap and she makes it over the top of the Paterberg. That's not the curious thing. She has maybe 10, 12 seconds. I knew Kasia was going to jump because she has to. She can't win a sprint against Vos. This is her last steep place to punch away. What I didn't expect, Benji, was Elisa Longo Borghini to be going toe-to-toe with her, even half-wheeling her on the Paterberg behind Shirin Van Enrooy.
Exactly. She crashed early this race before the Molenberg, but she's still in contention here. She's half-wheeling Nevyedova to the top, and a lot of people criticized what she did once she reached the top, which is she's now like 3 to 4 or 5 seconds basically away from Shirin Van Enrooy. And she keeps on pacing with Nevyedova in the wheel towards Van Enrooy. And I'm not really sure it's that terrible of a move. Like, the gap isn't huge. Would I probably have forced Kasia to close it or something? Maybe. But you also want to keep SD Works behind, you know. And I'd rather fight against Nevyedova with two riders than risk the rest coming back. Does that make sense?
Exactly. She's not worried about, well, she was at Amstel Gold Race in 2021. she's no longer worried about beating Kasia Niewiadoma in a sprint, it seems. But it did look very strange.
Yeah.
Because in theory, what you do is you have Kasia drag you to Sheeran Van Anroy.
Yeah.
And then you immediately counter Kasia, go solo, win the race that way. But maybe she was worried, okay, if there's Kopecky, Vos, Vollering pulling full gas, they're all heavier on the flat. I'm not going to make it solo, and Sheeran's not going to make it solo. And so maybe that's what she was thinking.
But I
have my personal view. My personal view is that Elisa Longoborghini had to win the race today.
Yeah, my opinion is also that Longoborghini wants Longoborghini to win the race.
Yeah.
I fully agree with that. And I'm basing that also on the fact that...
Not just this race.
The UAE Tour versus Guy Realini thing last year... That should also have been gifted. So yeah. Longoborghini likes Longoborghini winning the race. So that's why she closes it instead of tactical reasons in my head. But anyway, continue.
Well, even in the final. So basically, those three start relaying. Kasia is too generous as always, but she's also thinking, listen, I'm not going to beat Marianna Vos in a sprint behind. There's no use that group coming back. I can take my chances against Elisa Longoborghini. Sheeran Van Anroy, she's out on her feet. But... to your point, Benji, that gap goes to 25 seconds. It had even gone down to 13, but Kopecky, Vollering are also, the SD workers are dead on their feet. Vos looks the strongest in that group, and the trio go clear, 3Ks to go. Cash is still pulling through. She even goes in front of Elisa Longoborghini when she pulls at one point. I'm like, that's a risk, as she can counter from your wheel when you finish your turn. And then she keeps pulling. The turns eventually get a bit shorter. And I was thinking, and this is why Elisa Longoborghini had to win, Benji, because if otherwise, with the gap they had, you play Van Anroy as bait to do a proper to jump, but that's not what happens. She basically starts her a lead out slowly and then ramps it up. Kasia in the wheel, but still, Elisa Longoborghini had to be stronger than Kasia Niewiadoma in the sprint, and she was. Yep. She beats her in the sprint and wins the Tour of Flanders for a second time. 9 years after her first victory in 2015, ahead of Kasia Niewiadoma. I was hoping that we would break the drought today. I was really cheering for her. She hasn't won in 5 years. And I thought, why not break it with a monument victory? But she doesn't.
I have to be honest. When it comes to Kasia Niewiadoma, everyone and their dog wants her to win a race. Everyone and their dog wants her to win RVV in this situation. Do it in a 1v2 situation, stuff like that. But I gotta be honest, yes, it's unlikely that she wins against those two riders, but she's also not working well for herself either, eh? Like, I feel like she doesn't have the dog in her. I'm sorry, but if you pace, she paced longer in the group than Longoborghini did. She kept pulling longer than Longoborghini.
Yeah.
And there with two.
She's always too generous, unfortunately. And unfortunately, the races also don't finish uphill a lot of the time. So maybe if it's uphill, a sprint... would have helped, but yep, that's just how it is. Maybe she'll get the big one soon. She's in very good shape. Vos is also back to career best shape. She dusts everyone in the sprint for fourth. Kopecky fifth, which is actually, Vollering got dropped. So the SD workers all were the weakest and strongest of their team at varying points in the race. Peters is sixth, Persico seventh, UAE were quite good today. Vollering eighth, Paternoster, she's been a revelation, ninth, and Svinkels 10th. Vibers finished ahead of the group. Let's call it the peloton in 11th. But yeah, Paternoster and Alula Jaco, third in Dwars of Vlaandre, fourth in Drenthe, which is a world tour race, and now top 10 in Flanders. Very, very good result indeed for her. But SD Works, Benji, the dominance is over. We've been calling. This is what I called it a year early. I said in the 2023 season previews that Lidl Trek would go toe-to-toe, and now it's come to fruition.
Yeah, but... I gotta be honest, I don't feel like it is because Lidl Trek got significantly better over the last 3 years. I feel like it's more that SD Works this year is worse than they were in the last 3 years, especially compared to last year, because I have not been confident in Kopecky at all this year when it comes to the classic season. Going into this race, I wasn't expecting her to win this race. Was I expecting her to get dropped by 10 people on the climbs? No. So it was worse than I expected. They didn't put themselves in the right position either when it comes to the Koppenberg, so maybe that influences the race, but just haven't felt the confidence in Kopecky and Vollering that I've had in a while now. Maybe Vollering in the Hills Classics, I might expect a little more. than I expected from Kopecky so far. I also think Kopecky's best classic is yet to come, which is Roubaix on paper. So, I don't know. I think it's more that his D-Works is doing worse.
Yeah, Kopecky's worse. She has to be. She rode away from everyone on Quarmont last year and won by half a minute in like 15Ks. She rode away from everyone on Bosberg and Omloop last year, won by 12 seconds. She must be worse.
Yeah. And when it comes to the others, like, outside of his D-Works, everybody else is kind of where I roughly would have expected them, no?
Like, Weebs is better, or even?
Yeah, Weebs is, but I mean outside of his D-Works.
Oh, Lamborghini
fighting it out with Nivea Doma and Van Aanrooy.
Yeah, that's normal.
Van Aanrooy stepped up in the last 2 years, which is great to see, amazing to see. But those other two fighting each other, you'd expect that. Vos struggling on RVV parkour, I was kind of in her camp when it comes to potentially winning because I expected his D-Works to kind of keep it together better. But outside of that, all the riders are kind of... Paternoster, been riding amazing the last 2 weeks.
Yeah,
though.
And so, Sfinkels.
Yeah, so those two deserve that highlight. Sierra still cleaning up UCI points every now and then. But I would say that the rest is where I expect them to be. So in my opinion, it's just as D-Works doing a little worse.
I agree. Yeah, and Kasia's just, she's just missing that big one. She's always, like, she's, yeah, so close. And maybe in Amstel, this will be the year of La Flèche Wallonne with Vollering not and SD Works not looking as good.
Last thing, when it comes to the CX sirs that have jumped over, we've seen Puck Pietersen do amazing this year so far. Sam van Empel was good up to a certain point race as well. She cracked at a certain point, but she was also there for quite a bit in the last like 13 riders in this race. Van Empel's really young still, right? She's like 21,
yeah.
Younger than I expected. Peter's also 21. I reckon give us two more years and these two are fighting it out for the victory here.
I think so. Peterson for sure, because like she was in a chasse-patat behind Sharon Van Aanrooy for the whole of the chase before the last Quarmont and Paterberg, and she closed Sfinkels. Like, if they put her in good position and she's more economical with her actions before there, I think she can drop a lot of people on the Quarmont or Paterberg in years to come. So she's obviously a massive, massive talent, or even the Koppenberg. So I can't wait to see how she progresses. What has she done?
Quite a bit of races already.
8 race days, top 10 in 7 of them, and 6 of them were World Tour races. So she's pretty fucking good. And she's 21 years old, and she signed until the end of 2020. No, until, it's a bit strange, it says on PCS, until the end of February. She signed until the end of the cyclocross season of 2027. So if you want her for the road season... The 27, get in now. I don't know how
that's
that
funny.
Works.
You'll
I
miss don't... her for Omloop though.
True, yeah.
The 20th of February is when the contract ends.
I don't
that's
know
funny.
How that works with the UCI. Anyway, who knows if what the rules are in 4 years anyway. That wraps up Tour of Flanders though, Benji. Trek winning in one and Vanderpool. So the favourites winning in one. I don't even kind of remember who was the favourite. Probably Kopecky for the women's race. But how would you rate the Belgian classics before we do our Paris-Roubaix preview on Tuesday, Wednesday?
The Belgian classics, I think they were better than last year. Last year, SD-Works was so dominant that it became boring. As simple as that.
In both genders. In the women's, it was clearly better.
Yeah, for sure. Men's race, I feel like...
They're a bit mid, I think.
Yeah, they weren't that memorable. Like last year, there were also quite a few races that I'm quite forgettable about, but RVU was a banger of a race last year. Men's version.
E3 went to the line with the three big guns last year.
This year, the most amazing part of the race, I like Vanderpool. I've always said I love that he attacks from early in a lot of races, but at this point, it was also just masterly done by Alpecin and Vanderpool. But the best part about the race was the attrition behind for me.
Yeah, the best part for all these classics was kind of 100Ks to go, seeing what teams would try and do to upset the apple cart with varying degrees of success this year. Van Wevelhem, it worked out for Trek. In E3 and the Tour of Flanders for Visma, it did not work out too well. San Remo was good. San Remo was good. But opening weekend as well, Omloop was okay at the end, but also the Visma dominated like they did the year before as well in Dwars Door in the end. So,
what race is on Wednesday? Schelde Prijs?
Yeah, Philipsen is doing Schelde Prijs as the big favorite. Instead of a weekly show, Benji, we should do a little tour of Basque Country preview. We're gonna have daily pod recaps of Basque Country because we're not slacking, and also because the start list is ridiculous. Vingegaard, yeah. Kuss, Tullet, Evenepoel, Landa, Aaron Beru.
He's back.
Noah Enrique Mas, Roglic, Hindley, Sobrero, Schielmoser, Theo Gegenhardt, no Simon Yates, David Gaudu, Juan Ayuso, McNulty, Soler, Vine, Del Toro, Bilbao, Carlos Rodriguez, Hayter, Pidcock, Felix Gall, Sebastian Berwick. Ridiculous start list. Like, it's probably the best 1 week start list we're going to get this year, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but
it's just missing Poggi.
I fully agree. The start list looks amazing, but it's also a parkour where the riders will actively have to make the race, which
I think it's soft.
Yeah, it's very soft, but I like the fact that we might have to see the riders making the race for it to be interesting in the first place as well, which maybe a balance is better than that. But like, you, stage one, ITT, it's like a 10-kilometer ITT, kind of hilly, a hill in the middle, stuff like that. Stage two, a parkour with hills in it, but the hills are like 1.5 kilometers at 4%. So versatile sprint or an attack, maybe, I don't know. Next stage, we've got also 6 kilometers, 5% as the last climb, with a climb before that of 1.7 kilometers at 7.5%. That's a bit worse, a bit more difficult, but you can't make up 1 minute on this parkour either. Then I go to the next one, and this is stage four. This has a climb that could be fought on. 3.1 kilometers, 8.5%. That's where you can do something on. Next one, that's stage five. We've got 3.4 kilometers, 7.3%, twice in the last like 40 kilometers.
That's regular.
And obviously it's stage six is the race.
Stage six, the Arate crazy stuff. I think the parkour was much better last year. There was a Muri stage. There was the La Asturiana climb. With this, it kind of leads everyone to just go full gas in the TT and then wait for the Yarate stage. I guess, unless you're Remco, maybe that's a good thing, because you just accumulate bonus seconds and try and defend a TT lead if you get one.
I kind of agree, and it then depends on the other riders that are not having that great TT.
Peacock's got to go for state. He's got to go for bonies, no?
Yeah, but who else in the team? Is Hayter here?
Yeah. Hayter should win. Ineos should win two stages next week, Benji. Hayter should win stage two.
Yeah, but Hayter's sprint this year has not been impressive. Three.
Yeah, but Benji, he's sprinting against me. I'll have a look at the list. I know your boy Aaron Beru, he lose a one-up sprint, that man.
Yeah, well, he's just coming back from a collarbone injury as well, so I'm not sure.
Sprinter
is going to be that good.
The sprinters is Mauro Schmidt, who won a stage last year.
Emils Leppens.
He getting dropped, brother. He ain't making it.
I'm finding someone, dude. I'm finding some fucker that can win this.
Quinton Hermans and
Stan van Tricht as a duo.
Aula.
Alpecin should have sent Ulich to this race as sprinter. He could have cleaned the world tour win.
Yeah, Ineos got to win too. They got to go for Hayter here. I know he's had. You know, I would say to Hayter and the team, I would say there's no pressure, Ethan. But for every stage that we think suits you, we're going to pace for you to win. Even if he's like, please don't. Like, because, you know, and sometimes they pace and it doesn't work out. I'm sorry, they don't have a world tour win. Am I correct? In 24?
Correct.
If I'm Ineos, I'm pacing. And if he doesn't make it, then you go Pidcock reduced group on stage three or on stage five.
Are these not the kind of stages where you'd have a reduced group and would see the likes of Gregoire doing well in a U23 race 2 years ago, where you'd expect him to also be able to compete in a reduced group?
Yeah. Hayter is fast. He just in the group sprints can't do the hustle and bustle. If he's sprinting against some Basque 55-kilo guys.
I agree, but will he get to the front in time for the sprint to happen?
Yeah, because he's got to bully Luca Vergolito and Louis Mankies instead of some bigger guys. I'm sorry, they gotta go Pidcock, Hayter. It's really good race for those Ineos guys next week. And then obviously stage six is always just always insane stages crack. Like, I can't wait for that. Who you got winning?
How different would you rate the sprint of Hayter versus the sprint of, I don't know, let's say
Pogacar.
The kind of GC riders with a sprint. The Del Toro, Ayuso, Evenepoel's with a sprint.
Way quicker. Way quicker.
I don't think it's way quicker.
Nah, he quicker. On the flat.
2 years ago, I would have said yes.
He quicker.
This year, I'm not impressed.
Okay. All right, compared to those guys, like, on the flat, he's quicker.
He should do it, but, like, the sprint he lost against Cyril Barff, Laurence...
Yeah, he's a sprint. They're sprinters, man. They're actuals. They can sprint.
Cyril Barth's not a sprinter.
He is.
Where's the sprint results?
I don't know. Are you talking that? Yeah, but that's positioning. He hit the wind on that Catalunya stage before everybody else. He's quick. He's quick-ish.
If Hayter is what he wants to become or what he was 2 years ago, then he should be cleaning up more than one sprint.
I'm saying if I'm Ineos, I don't care. We need to win a... If I'm them, they have to win a World Tour race. Have to.
Yeah.
I don't care. We're going for it next week because it's a realistic chance Hayter or Pidcock could win. Who you got winning GC? Jonas Cleanup? Or
mate, Aller is here. No?
Yeah, but true, he's pretty good.
He's like the fastest guy on the start list next to Hayter.
You reckon Remco wins or Jonas or Roglic comes back?
What Vingegaard will we see in the time trial? Probably not the greatest time trial in his history, I would reckon. So,
nah, I think he'll do a good TT. His TT in Tirreno was really, really good.
The last stage is really decisive. Looking at the team strength of the team.
They got Lando.
On paper, Vingegaard should be able to make the difference necessary on the last stage. Sorry, but Krabbelin is fucking hard.
Krabbelin's really, really difficult. And yeah, if he goes crazy there with... that's who you got podium? Remco and Jai Hindley, for me.
Vingegaard, Remco... I don't want to pick the same podium as you, though. So I'm going to go for...
Is that Ayuso? There's Del Toro.
I'll go for Ayuso in third.
I think it's a bad race for Del Toro.
I agree. But to be honest, he won a stage like these in Tour Down Under. So for a stage win, maybe.
Do not compare some. I mean, Tour Down is a great race and all, but don't compare it to the Basque Country Series stage.
There was a better start list for those kind of stages.
No, it was not. Oh, Stevie. Mate, if Stevie Williams was here, he'd win four stages.
Mate, Corbin Strong.
Williams always will make it.
They're sprinting against each other usually in the sprint. Internet under. So.
Yeah, Pithian. Can Pithy get from... Can he get from Brussels to Bilbao in time?
I don't think so, my friend. He probably can, actually.
He can do anything, that man. Look out for Paul Lepera, top three in one of these sprint stages. Otherwise, yeah, as Benji said, the race is shoulder press on Wednesday. That's, depending on wind conditions, can be really exciting. There's Merlier against Philipsen, against Tesson, against Welsford. I'll be watching that for sure. And then we'll also have our Paris-Roubaix preview. Other than that, there's not any major races on. That's the only dot pro, I believe, this week outside of the Basque Country. So, yeah. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. It was a long one, of course, but it'll keep you going for a couple of days. Let us know who you got for the Basque Country TT tomorrow. I'm picking Juan Ayuso. Till then, ciao.